no longer an emperor, and when the imperial power was being exercised by a woman, it seemed to Pope Leo himself, and to the whole Christian people, that it would be fitting to give the title of emperor to the king of the Franks, Charles. Charles's biographer, Einhard, claims that Charlemagne knew nothing about the plan to crown him, and denied ever wanting the imperial title. But he is the only writer who assumes such massive ignorance on the part of the sharp-minded and wary king. The crowning on Christmas Day was simply a formal recognition of an authority that Charlemagne had been claiming for some time. The authority to stand as the protector of faith, guarantor of civilization, and highest civil power in the Christian world. In Constantinople, the coronation was scorned as meaningless, but Irene was not in a good position to defend herself as the true protector of the faith and guarantor of civilization. Her rule had been chaotic, murderous, and ineffective. In 802, her finance minister led a coup against her and removed her from the throne. He forced her to go into exile within the walls of a monastery she had built herself, and was crowned emperor in her place as Nikephoros I. The following year, Nikephoros I approached Charlemagne by way of ambassadors and suggested a treaty that would protect the city of Venice, still Byzantine loyal, from Frankish occupation. Eventually the two men came to an agreement, the Pax Nicephori. Nikephoros I and Byzantium would keep control of Venice and its important port. In return, Charlemagne would receive a generous annual payment. The terms made it very clear that this was a treaty between equals, but in signing it, Nikephoros I gave himself the imperial title, yet refused to call Charlemagne emperor. Chapter 52. The New Sennacherib. Between 786 and 814, Abbasid merchants spread across the west. Charlemagne becomes protector of the faith in Jerusalem, and the Bulgarian Khan Krum nearly brings Constantinople down. The Abbasid caliph Harun al-Rashid was more willing than Nikephoros I to court Charlemagne's goodwill. As an Abbasid ally, Charlemagne could not only halt Byzantine expansion to the west, but also help guard Abbasid interests against the breakaway Umayyad realm in Al-Andalus, the Emirate of Cordoba. Those interests had more to do with trade routes than with conquest. Harun al-Rashid had been elevated to the caliphate in 786, after the death of his father, Al-Mandi, and very soon had earned himself the nickname the Righteous. One of his first acts as caliph was to lead the annual pilgrimage to Mecca in person, and when he arrived in Arabia, he gave enormous money gifts to the leaders of both Mecca and Medina. "Through Harun, the light has shone forth in every region," declared one of his court poets, "and the straight path has become established by the justness of his conduct. He is a leader whose greatest concern is with raiding the infidels and the pilgrimage." In actuality, al-Rashid was more interested in trading than raiding. He did not completely neglect the ongoing war with Byzantium, but during the first 15 years of his caliphate, he was more concerned with security and prosperity than with conquest. Most of his energies went into establishing and guarding trade routes. 10 years after his accession, he moved his court from Baghdad to Ar-Raqqa, which was closer to the northern trade routes into Khazar territory. Thanks to a semi-peace with the Khazar Khan, Arab merchants were now able to travel up north through the Caspian Gates, the pass through the mountains just west of the Caspian Sea, to the Volga River, where they could trade not only with the Khazars, but also with Scandinavian merchants. By the 8th century, adventurers from the northern Scandinavian kingdoms had crossed the Baltic Sea and built little trading posts southward along the rivers that reached down into Europe. They offered furs, exotic and luxurious, to the Arab buyers, and they wanted gold and silver coins, which were scarce in their own lands. Al-Rashid's care for the trade routes meant that the Arab hand reached into far distant lands that had remained untouched by conquest. Embassies between Charlemagne's court and al-Rashid's imperial palace at Ar-Raqqa travelled back and forth. The Arab ambassadors took the sea route from the Mediterranean coast, south around Italy and up to the port city of Genoa, and then travelling north to Charlemagne's court at Aachen, his newly chosen capital city. With the ambassadors, al-Rashid sent gifts, a water-driven clock, a chess set, spices, and an albino elephant named Abdul Abbas, which had been captured from an Indian king. Charlemagne liked the idea of a war elephant. He took it on campaign with him when he had to fight against invading Scandinavians to the north, which undoubtedly startled them. Al-Rashid's coins ended up even farther away than his elephant. Sometime around the turn of the century, one of his merchants paid a gold dinar into the hands of a Scandinavian trader, who took it north and used it to buy goods from an Anglo-Saxon merchant, who sailed home with the coin and landed at a port in the English kingdom of Mercia. Mercia, which by this point had expanded to cover a good bit of the southeast of England, was under the rule of King Offa, a Christian monarch who considered himself almost equal to Charlemagne in dignity. Author's note: Christianity had spread through southern England after Augustine's mission to the court of Ethelbert in 596. In 664, the Synod of Whitby declared England to be a Christian country, subject to the authority of the Pope. Offa even suggested, by way of diplomatic correspondence, that his son and heir should marry one of Charlemagne's daughters, which Charlemagne found so presumptuous that he closed Frankish ports for a while to Mercian ships. Once in Mercia, the merchant used the coin to buy a night's lodging from an innkeeper, who later that year used it to pay the king's tax collector, and so it came into the hands of Offa's silversmith, who was mulling over the designs for the next year's English coinage. He liked the pretty patterns on Al-Rashid's gold dinar, and decided to copy them. The following year, the coins of the English monarch were minted with Offa Rex written on one side, and the Arabic words for "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet" on the other. The silversmith, of course, had no idea what the words said. Offa Rex is written right side up, but the Arabic letters are all upside down. Back in Ar-Raqqa, enriched by trade with such far-flung lands, and also by his practice of confiscating the goods of his wealthy subjects when they died, Al-Rashid grew richer and richer. His splendor was so great that it became legendary. Less than two generations after his death, tales were already weaving themselves around him. Within a century, those tales would begin to take shape as the sprawling Arabian Nights, 1,001 nights' worth of stories about thieves and heroes, courtesans and queens, with Harun al-Rashid and his gesture at the center of the adventures. Al-Rashid was also careful with the empire's defenses. He fortified the eastern borders of the empire by making an alliance with the Tang Emperor, Tang Xunzong, in order to check the power of the Tibetans, who threatened to push into Arabic land near the Oxus River. He defended the western borders by authorizing ongoing raids into Byzantine land, finally forcing Nikephoros I to hand over a sizable annual tribute in order to keep the peace, 300,000 dinars, which worked out to around a ton and a quarter of gold added to the caliph's treasury each year. Author's note: the dinar was a gold coin with a standard weight of 4.25 grams. The dirham was a silver coin of 3 grams. Typically, 20 dirhams equaled 1 dinar. In 807, Al-Rashid granted Charlemagne yet another proof of the Frankish king's high place in the Christian hierarchy. He agreed to make a decree that protected the Christian holy sites in Jerusalem, which was under Arab governance. Christian pilgrims would be allowed, without restriction, to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, said to stand on Golgotha, the hill of the crucifixion, the Via Dolorosa, way of suffering, the path taken by Christ on the way to his death, and the other landmarks of their faith. It was a decree that would naturally have been sent to the Pope, the spiritual father of all Christians, but Al-Rashid directed his pledge to Charlemagne, and promised special treatment for Frankish pilgrims in particular. At the same time, the Bishop of Jerusalem sent two monks to Aachen, so they could present Charlemagne with the key to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself. Even though the Pope himself had crowned Charlemagne as protector of the faith, these must have been sharp-edged little pills for Leo III to swallow. Meanwhile, the Emperor of Constantinople, Nikephoros I, had been given little leisure to complain about Charlemagne's usurpation of his role as Emperor of the Romans. He was too busy worrying about the Khan of the Bulgarians, who had rocketed, without much attention paid to him by contemporary historians, into a position as one of the great rulers of the West. The Bulgarian Khan was named Krum, and under his rule, which began sometime between 796 and 803, Bulgaria swelled into a major power. Krum's southern territories lay directly against the Byzantine border, and Constantine VI's disastrous attempt to defy the Bulgarian Khan Kardam, Krum's predecessor and possibly his uncle, had clearly revealed just how vulnerable the Byzantine territory now was. Nikephoros knew this. Around 805, Krum invaded the territory of the once great Avars and folded it into his own, which brought his empire directly to the eastern border of Charlemagne. Deciding not to wait until Krum became even more powerful, Nikephoros declared war on the Bulgarians and began to arm his troops. It took him over a year to get the troops on the road, partly because he had to put down a palace rebellion in the middle of his preparations. But by 808, he was moving troops into the Strymon River Valley on the southern Bulgarian border. Krum's men descended on them before they were at full strength and drove them back, killing a number of soldiers and officers and, even more damaging, capturing all of the money Nikephoros had sent along with his generals to use for payroll, 1,100 pounds of gold, according to Theophanes. Hostilities now began in earnest. In 809, Krum led his army against the city of Serdica, a frontier city within Byzantine territory, and captured it, slaughtering 6,000 Byzantine soldiers and hundreds of civilians. Nikephoros did not handle the defeat well. The officers who had escaped the massacre, afraid that they would be blamed and executed, sent him a message asking for immunity. When he refused, they all deserted and joined the Bulgarian army. It took Nikephoros I, who was again distracted by yet another rebellion at home, this one brought about by his decision to raise everyone's taxes, more than a year to prepare his army for a return attack. He had decided that the only appropriate response was to wipe Krum out entirely, and to that end he imported soldiers from Thracia and Asia Minor to beef up the depleted forces at Constantinople. In 811, the Byzantine army marched towards Krum's headquarters at Pliska, just west of the Black Sea. At first, Krum's defenders were defeated and pushed backwards as the Byzantine army advanced. Alarmed by the ferocity of the approaching troops, Krum decided to abandon Pliska. Nikephoros arrived at the Bulgarian capital on July 20th, at the head of his army, and ordered his men to slaughter the population, take the goods, and burn the place down. He ordered that senseless animals, infants, and persons of all ages should be slain without mercy, Theophanes writes. He finally had the upper hand, and he refused to listen to a message from Krum suggesting a treaty. But Krum was not finished. He had retreated, along with every man he could recruit, into the mountains through which the Byzantine army would have to march on their way home, and had built a wooden wall across the pass. On July 25th, heading for Constantinople in triumph, Nikephoros and his men ran directly into the wooden wall. The Bulgarians attacked the trapped army as it piled up in front of the barrier. Nikephoros, fighting at the front, was killed almost at once. Soldiers who tried to climb the wall and escape fell into an enormous ditch that the Bulgarians had dug on the other side and filled with burning logs. The Byzantine troops were slaughtered. Krum turned out to be no more gracious in victory than his opponent. He beheaded the emperor's corpse, stuck the head on a pole, and, once the flesh had rotted off, had the skull coated in silver so that he could use it as a drinking goblet. Meanwhile, Nikephoros's son and second-in-command, Staurakios, had escaped, badly wounded by a blow to his spine. His companions hauled him back to Constantinople, where he was crowned emperor in his father's place while lying on a litter. But Staurakios's wound proved incurable. He sank into paralysis, and by October was forced to give power over to his brother-in-law, Michael Rangab. Early the next year, Staurakios died. For months, he had suffered from pressure ulcers on his back, and the wounds turned gangrenous. No one could bear to approach him because of the foul stench, Theophanes writes. Krum suggested to Michael Rangab that it was time for a truce, but even when the Bulgarian king began to approach Constantinople, by early 812 most of Thracia was in Bulgarian hands, the new emperor refused to come to terms. Krum was the second, or perhaps third, most powerful sovereign in Europe for a time, but his skull goblet represented a world of savage barbarity. In Michael Rangab's eyes, Krum was a Khan, not a king. A wild man, not an equal. A barbarian, not the ruler of a Western kingdom. In such a strait, Michael Rangab decided that it would be more palatable to make his treaty with Charlemagne. The Frankish king might be presumptuous, but he was Christian, and the Franks were at least 2 centuries past dismembering enemies and using their body parts for tableware. As Krum drew near to the city walls, Michael Rangab agreed to acknowledge Charlemagne's claim to be emperor. But the language of the agreement reveals its grudging nature. Michael Rangab hailed Charlemagne as emperor of the Franks and praised him for the establishment of his Roman Empire. But nowhere, at any time, did he call him emperor of the Romans. In exchange for this unwilling admission, Charlemagne agreed to stop contesting Byzantine possession of the Italian city of Venice and its port. Reassured that Krum would now find an enemy at his back, Michael Rangarb resumed the battle against the Bulgarians. By 813, he had recaptured some of the Thracian territory and had set his army up for a massive war-ending confrontation near Adrianople. The two armies met on June 22nd. The Christians were grievously worsted in battle, writes Theophanes, and the enemy won, so much so that most of the Christians had not even waited for the first clash before they took to headlong flight. Clearly, Michael's army had serious doubts about the wisdom of the assault. Michael Rangarb was forced to flee back to Constantinople. Krum chased him to its walls, and then laid siege to the city. Once back inside the walls, Michael Rangarb offered to abdicate, in the face of almost certain assassination, should he remain on the throne. The army and the officers had despaired of being ruled by him any longer, and had decided that Leo the Armenian, military governor of the Byzantine lands in Asia Minor, should be acclaimed as the new emperor. After a token protest, Leo the Armenian accepted and marched from Asia Minor to Constantinople. He fought his way into the city and was crowned Emperor Leo V by the Patriarch on July 12th, while Michael and his sons took refuge in a church and put on monks' clothes to demonstrate their willingness to give up power. This saved their lives, but not their manhood. Leo V's first act was to castrate Michael's sons before sending them off into monastic exile, wiping out any chance that they might later claim the legitimate rule of Byzantium. In the meantime, Krum was terrifying the city, not least by carrying out a demon-summoning sacrifice right in front of the Golden Gate. He was, in the words of Theophanes, the new Sennacherib. The Assyrian king of ancient times had tried to wipe out the people of God when he attacked Jerusalem, and Krum was doing the same. Leo V offered to meet with Krum under a flag of truce, but he had no intention of honouring the conventions of such a meeting. Conventions governed Christian monarchs, but they did not constrain emperors to treat barbarians like real kings. When Krum approached the meeting place, just outside the city walls, Leo's men tried to assassinate him. Through their incompetence, Theophanes writes, they merely wounded him and did not inflict a fatal blow. Krum escaped, but he was too weakened by his injuries to continue the siege. In fury, he ordered his army to sack the land around Constantinople before he was forced to retreat back towards his homeland to recover. On the way, he burned a good part of Thracia and took scores of captives, whom he settled in Bulgaria as exiles and constant reminders of the Byzantine treachery. Once recovered, Krum began to plan a final assault on Constantinople, but he was still preparing for the attack when, in 814, he died. Without Krum's fury behind it, the Bulgarian juggernaut lost some of its momentum. Leo V, sending his army against the Bulgarians in an attempt to drive them back out of Thracia, began to have some success. Before long, Krum's successor, his son Umurtag, agreed to a 30-year peace. The crisis had ended, but the wild man had almost brought the empire of the Greeks down. More than that, Krum's reign began a Bulgarian dynasty that would control the country without interruption for a century. With the help of the Christianity that was already spreading from the Byzantine captives through the Bulgarian population, the descendants of Krum would begin to shape the Bulgarian horde into a state that could take its place among the kingdoms of the West. Chapter 53. Castle Lords and Regents. Between 790 and 872, the aristocratic clans take control of Silla, and the Fujiwara take control of Japan. The kings of unified Silla and Balhae, east of the crumbling Tang, were adjusting to the new landscape. In the absence of the Tang soldiers who had kept hostilities alive between them, they had worked out a treaty. For the first time in decades, the Sillans were not fighting an unending war. They could put some thought, instead, into Silla's internal workings. These were not in the best of shape. By the 8th century, power in Silla was based almost entirely on bloodline, known as bone rank. An aristocrat whose parents were both of royal descent could boast hallowed bone status. If only one parent was royal, the child was true bone. Until the middle of the 7th century, only hallowed bone aristocrats had ruled in Silla. But after the time of King Muyol the Great, who had begun the unification of the peninsula by conquering Bakjai in 660, true bone aristocrats had held the Sillan throne. Below the privilege level of those who could claim royal parentage were layers and layers of nobles who held various head ranks in decreasing importance, according to the purity of their family descent. There were 17 bone ranks in all, and those not born to rank could count on a life without privilege. In Silla, the bone rank is the key to employment, an official named Siol Kiedu had written in disgust. If one is not of the nobility, no matter what his talents, he cannot achieve a high rank. I wish to travel west to China. Siol Kiedu did eventually go to China, where he hoped to earn rank by performing his duties well. The Confucian academies of 8th century China allowed diligent students to work their way up through the ranks by demonstrating virtue and mastery of the orderly rituals that gave Confucian society its framework. But back in Silla, the bone rank system continued to congeal Silan society into elaborate and unmoving stratifications, concentrating power only in the hands of the aristocrats and barring capable commoners from ever rising higher. Around 790, King Wansiong of Silla began to work out a way to bypass the stiff, unyielding categories. Wansiong was true bone by birth, but he was not in the direct royal line. He had been crowned 5 years before as the successor to his cousin Siondiok, who had died without sons. Wansiong owed his power to the very true bone nobleman whose insistence on hereditary privilege was weakening the country. Nevertheless, he was determined to get capable administrators back into power. So 3 years after his coronation, he installed a new state examination system. Rather than claiming official positions because of bone rank, candidates would have to show understanding of the Chinese texts and principles taught in the National Confucian Academy, which had been founded in Goguryeo in the 4th century and had managed to survive during the following chaotic centuries. King Wansiong built his new examination system around its teachings. Virtue and intelligence, not mere social connections, were the qualities Silla needed in its leaders. This return to an emphasis on learning, rather than mere heritage, was supported by Confucian monks such as Xiao Cheng, who grew famous for his ability to take Chinese classics and transcribe them into the language spoken by the people. He interpreted the 9 classics in the vernacular and taught the young, his biographer tells us in the Samguk Sagi. This was no easy task. Since writing had come to the Korean peninsula from China, Chinese characters were used by the learned, but they were used primarily to write in Chinese, and the language of Silla still remained without a writing system of its own. To finish his translations, Siol Cheng was forced to invent a new system that used Chinese characters to represent Sillan words. The match between characters and words was awkward and imperfect, with tens of thousands of Sillan words left unwritten, but Siol Cheng's method survived for almost 700 years. The peninsula, very slowly, was inching out from beneath the vast umbrella of Chinese culture. Like Siol Cheng's writing system, Wansiong's reforms were imperfect. His attempts to open the government up to those of lower or no bone ranks were unpopular with the true bone aristocrats, who saw their hold on power loosening. The most powerful official in the Silan government, the Vice Minister of State, Chipsabu Sirang, led the resistance to Wansiong's efforts, and the king's position was further weakened when his son died before him, leaving a grandson in poor health as his only heir. When King Wansiong died in 798, the grandson, King Sosiong, ruled for less than 2 years before his own death. Sosiong's young son, Ayajong, was then crowned, but he was not yet 13, and power was held by his uncle who served as his regent. This brought unified Silla into a time of slow decline, known to historians as the Late Period. The turnover of rulers was frequent and violent. In 809, young King Ayajong was murdered by his uncle, who ascended the throne as King Haeondeok. Immediately, Haeondeok had to put down a rebellion, led by a descendant of King Muyol, who used the excuse of the usurpation to declare himself king in the central city of Cheongju. The revolt was quashed, rose up again under the rebel leader's son, and was quashed a second time. Wansiong's descendants remained on the throne, but the monarch was losing his mandate, and although the aristocracy of Silla had joined in resisting the king's reforms, the nobles didn't stay united for long. Instead, men of high bone rank collected private armies and began to fight amongst themselves for the chunks of power they had pried from the king's hands. In struggling to keep the power to which they had been born, they inadvertently began to change the basis of that very power. Increasingly, the size and skill of a man's private army, not his bone rank, became the source of his influence. The usurping Haeondeok died in 826. His successor, his brother Haeyongdeok, faced a struggling, armed countryside. The king's forces had withdrawn inwards, towards the capital. Pirates from China roamed the coast, blocking the trade routes, kidnapping unwary Silans and selling them into slavery. When Heungdeok's young commander, Chang Pogo, asked for permission to establish a coastal garrison on the southwestern island of Wando, Heungdeok agreed at once. The king gave Chang an army of 10,000 men, the Samguk Sagi tells us, and bade him pitch camp on the island. Chang's patrol of the Yellow Sea drove most of the pirates out of Silla's waters, but it also made him increasingly powerful. In his offshore base, out of sight of the king, he built himself a little private kingdom of his own. When Heungdeok died without sons, open war broke out. His cousin and nephew fought over the throne. One was killed, the other committed suicide after less than a year on the throne, and a third relative claimed the crown. He too was removed in a matter of months by Chang Pogo, now master of the Yellow Sea, and Chang Pogo's ally Kim U-jin. Together, the two men marched into the capital of Gyeongju. Kim U-jin had himself crowned as King Sinmu, and Chang Pogo took up the position of power behind the throne. Sinmu lasted for all of 4 months before an illness struck him down. His son Munseong was crowned in his place. But unlike his predecessors, Munseong managed to hang on to the throne for almost 2 decades, in large part because the Silan nobility and their private armies were beginning to work out a satisfactory division of power. Rather than fighting for control of the capital city and the crown, they turned outwards. Like Chang Pogo, they built themselves little private enclaves in outlying areas, where they reigned supreme. From their personal kingdoms, they traded, as Chang Pogo had, with the merchants of Tang China and with Japan, building their wealth as well as their power. King Munseong survived so long in part because he had become increasingly irrelevant. In 846, Chang Pogo, who had provided the blueprint for these private kingdoms, proposed to marry his daughter to King Munseong, which would have given him a royal connection to add to his private army and his control of the sea. This was too much power for the true-bone aristocrats to take, and several of them joined together to mastermind Chang Pogo's assassination. This left Munseong on the throne, but not in control. In less than a century, unified Silla had become a country unified only in name. The most powerful aristocrats, with the largest private armies, erected fortresses at the center of their domains, ruling them almost as independent petty kings. They were called castle lords and exercised the right to collect taxes for themselves without passing any of the money on to the putative center of government in Gyeongju. The Buddhist monasteries that dotted the countryside took advantage of the king's weakness to do the same, collecting land and tax revenues on their own account. Farmers and tradesmen, with no armies and no protection from the king, increasingly began to turn outlaw, and robber bands roamed through the hills. Silla was tottering and about to fall. Just across the water to the east, a few clouds had begun to drift across the light cast by the heavenly sovereign of Japan, the pole star of his people. Heavenly Sovereign Kamu sat on the throne, but he no longer ruled from Nara, the capital where the Yoro Code had been published. Instead, he had decided to break with the past. Now he ruled from a brand new court, 30 miles northwest, in the city of Nagaoka. Author's note, not the same as the modern city of Nagaoka. Kamu was the pole star of Japan, the country's connection with the divine, the guarantor of order and law. But these resounding responsibilities were rapidly becoming symbolic. Power in Japan was scattered through the countryside, where clan leaders continued to claim their own authority. The chronicles from Kamu's reign suggest that the monasteries and aristocrats of Nara had been actively gathering more and more wealth and power to themselves. In the year of the move to the new court, one account tells us, the Buddhist temples in the capital were forbidden to accumulate wealth in an unreasonable manner, while the wealthy were forbidden to make loans to the poor in exchange for mortgages on their homesteads. Like the monasteries, the aristocrats had been lending money at usurious rates and claiming the farms of those who could not pay. One particular aristocratic clan, the Fujiwara, descendants of Nakatome no Kamatari, lifelong friend of the heavenly sovereign Tenji, had become more powerful in Nara than all the rest. The Fujiwara clan had inherited from Nakatome no Kamatari the privilege of overseeing court rites and rituals, a responsibility that gave Fujiwara officials control over the center of the palace. By the beginning of Kamu's rule, there were no fewer than 4 major branches of the family living in and around the capital city. Kamu moved to Nagaoka in large part to get away from the Fujiwara courtiers who surrounded him at every moment of the day. The move was made in a frenzy, almost desperate in its haste. 300,000 men, working around the clock, built an entire royal complex in less than 6 months. But although he could leave Nara behind, he could not escape the tentacles of Fujiwara power. His chief consort was the daughter of a Fujiwara nobleman. The posts of Great Minister of the Right and Great Minister of the East were held by Fujiwaras, and he was forced by necessity to appoint a Fujiwara official as overseer of his new capital city. For 10 years, Heavenly Sovereign Kamu lived in his expensive palace in Nagaoka. He was battered by bad luck, illness, death in his family, and bloody infighting among his court officials, and by 794 he had decided that a curse hung over the city. He would not go back to Nara, which had been equally troublesome for him. Instead, he moved the capital again, this time to the city of Yamashiro no Kuni. Rather wistfully, he ordered it renamed Heian-kyo, Capital of Peace. This time the move stuck. Nagaoka slowly crumbled away, while Heian, modern Kyoto, remained the capital of Japan for nearly 1,000 years. Author's note, the move to Heian marked the end of the Nara period, 750 to 794, and the beginning of the Heian period, 794 to 5585 in Japanese history. Kamu died in 806, after ruling for over 2 decades and fathering 32 children. Between 806 and 833, he was succeeded by 3 of his sons in turn. These sons shared a single characteristic. Each one abdicated, handing the throne over to the next. The oldest, Heizei, was on the throne for only 3 years when he became seriously ill and abdicated in favor of his younger brother Saga. Author's note, Heizei recovered unexpectedly and mounted an attempt to get the throne back, which ended badly. Saga resisted. Heizei's accomplices were arrested or committed suicide, and the ex-heavenly sovereign was forced to enter a Buddhist monastery, where he remained until his death 14 years later. After 14 years, heavenly sovereign Saga abdicated as well, and the throne went to the third brother, Junna. Junna reigned for 10 years before handing the crown to his nephew, Ninmyo, Saga's 23-year-old son, in 833. All of these abdications made one thing very clear. The heavenly sovereign was no emperor, not in the sense of a Chinese or Byzantine or Persian emperor. He did not rule, as they did, controlling armies and laws. He shone, and in his light, power was dispersed to others. Fujiwara officials controlled the day-to-day running of the court and its rituals. The provinces farther away from the city were controlled by their governors, who were responsible for collecting their own taxes, and who quite often used those taxes for their own purposes, rather than passing them on to the capital. They were not above padding the tax bills either, and both inside and outside of the capital, the farmers and small tradesmen of Japan found themselves under continual pressure to hand over more of their meager profits. This extortion, unchecked by the heavenly sovereign, fell on a countryside already strained by Kamu's 2 successive moves. Each change of the capital city had required a raise in taxes to pay for the new construction and the drafting of able-bodied farmers into a temporary workforce to build the emperor's new residences. A note in the Royal Chronicles for 842, during the reign of the heavenly sovereign Ninmyo, gives us a glimpse of grotesque poverty just outside Heian's own walls. The office of the capital was ordered to gather up and burn some 5,500 skulls lying around, the chronicler tells us. The peasants who lived along the Kamo River, which flowed past Heian, were so poor that they could not afford tombs or deep graves for their dead. Instead, they scratched holes in the sand for the bodies, and as the river wore the sand away, the bones were flung up onto the shore. The heavenly sovereign, Ninmyo, abdicated in 850. He had married a Fujiwara noblewoman, and his half-Fujiwara son, Montoku, became the heavenly sovereign. Montoku, 23 when he inherited his crown, had little to do during his royal days. The Fujiwara officials were ruling the country on his behalf, and he seems to have spent most of his time in the women's quarters of the palace. By the time he was in his early 30s, he had fathered 27 children. But his primary consort was Akira Keiko, daughter of the ambitious Fujiwara nobleman Fujiwara no Yoshifusa. Yoshifusa engineered the marriage, watched with satisfaction as Akira Keiko gave birth to a son and heir, and then leveraged his connection with the throne to be appointed chief minister, Daijo Daijin, in 857. The heavenly sovereign Montoku died just 1 year later, at the age of 32. His son, Sewa, 8 years old, was crowned his heir. And Yoshifusa, the child's Fujiwara grandfather, had himself appointed as Sessho, or regent, for the underage king. It was the first time that an outsider, someone not from the royal line, had been given the job of regent, but by this time the royal line and the Fujiwara clan had become so intertwined that the whole concept of a separate royal line was merely symbolic as the power of the young heavenly sovereign. Sewa sat on the throne as the pole star, beautiful, honored, and powerless. The Sessho ruled on his behalf. Even when Sewa reached the age of the maturity, the Sessho remained on. He was an official outside of the law, beyond the royal sphere, with his power derived from the heavenly sovereign, but eclipsing its source. Yoshifusa even arranged Sewa's marriage for him, wedding him to Yoshifusa's own niece, the young ruler's first cousin once removed. This made him, simultaneously, the emperor's grandfather, regent, and uncle-in-law. The marriage created one more tie between the royal line and the Fujiwara clan, one more point of reflected power. The young woman herself, Takaiko, was given no choice in the matter. She had a lover of her own, but later poems tell of his unpleasant fate. He was exiled from court, forced to enter a monastery, and did not see his beloved again until he had grown old and feeble. In 872, Yoshifusa died, but he passed the power of his office on to his adopted son, Fujiwara no Mototsune. Heavenly Sovereign Sewa was at this time 22, and in no real need of a regent, but Mototsune was anxious to exercise the full power of his office. 4 years later, he convinced Sewa to abdicate at the age of 26 and hand the crown over to the heir apparent, Sewa's 5-year-old son, Yozie. To die and leave the throne to a child was often unavoidable, but to abdicate in favor of a child shows one thing clearly. The heavenly sovereign no longer needed to rule. The Sessho, refracting his glory, would rule for him. The sovereign himself needed merely to exist, a necessary but passive node of connection with the divine order. Chapter 54. The Triumph of the Outsiders. Between 806 and 918, military governors, rebels, and Turks destroy the Tang, and the period of the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms begins, while rebel commanders and exiled princes divide unified Silla into the later Three Kingdoms. The Tang Empire was shrunken and struggling, but all was not lost. In the aftermath of the Anlushan Rebellion, the Tang emperors had managed to restore a reasonably effective system of tax collection. The sale of salt was now a royal monopoly, pouring yet more cash into the royal coffers. The crown was weakened, but not poverty-stricken. Taxes and salt may have been under royal control, but the outlying provinces that had once been firmly under Tang rule definitely were not. Far too many of the Fan Zhen, the military governors appointed by earlier emperors, had turned into mini-monarchs, controlling their own lands. Some of these military commanders were of Chinese ancestry. Many others were of barbarian descent, warrior chiefs who had been allowed to settle their people within Tang borders and had, in exchange, agreed to defend the Tang land against outside invaders. The loyalty of the Fan Zhen to the Tang varied widely. Some of the border peoples, like the Turkish tribe of the Shatuo, were transforming themselves into Chinese, while others ignored the emperor at Chang'an. The borders of the Tang Empire had gotten not just permeable, but indistinct. The farther from Chang'an a traveller got, the harder it was to figure out whether or not he had left Tang land. In 806, the emperor Tang Xianzong began an attempt to restore his power in these outlying lands. In a series of wars fought between 806 and 817, he slowly whipped the Fan Zhen back into the fold. When he captured the recalcitrant governors, he brought them to the capital city and had them executed. By 820, he had almost managed to restore the palace's control over the old Tang land. And then, just as he reached for the final prize of a unified empire, the vigorous young emperor died. He was only 42, and it was whispered that 2 court eunuchs who resented the emperor's power had poisoned him. It was more than whispered that his son and heir, Muzong, had a hand in the unexpected death. Whether or not this was true, Muzong ascended the throne and let his father's conquests slip away. Both Tang Muzong and his successor, his son Tang Jingzong, were known for their devotion to banqueting and ball games. They allowed the court eunuchs to run the day-to-day operations of the palace, and one chronicler laments that the business of the state was almost entirely given up. By 827, the Fan Zhen were once again entrenched in their independent fortresses, and the palace eunuchs were thoroughly in control of the doings at court. They murdered Tang Jingzong, who was 18 and had ruled less than 3 years, and instead supported the coronation of Jingzong's younger brother, Tang Wenzong. Tang Wenzong remained alive and on the throne for 14 years, but only because he was willing to relinquish the real power of the throne to the Fan Zhen on the edges of his empire and the officials in his palace, most of whom were eunuchs, thus less likely to seize the throne in hopes of establishing a dynasty. This state of affairs could have led to chaos and disorganization, as in fact it had in unified Silla, but the eunuchs did a perfectly adequate job of running the country. In 838, 12 years into Wenzong's puppet reign, the Japanese monk Enin travelled to Tang China. His travel diary chronicled a well-organized, efficient state that appeared to be prospering. He remarks, impressed, that there were over 4,000 shops in one central district in the capital city, Chang'an, that the canals were lined on both sides with rich and noble houses quite without a break, that the river was filled with merchant ships and boats carrying the royal salt. Efficient administrators though they were, the eunuchs would have been helpless in any military crisis. They were bureaucrats, given no training in the art of warfare. But by pure good luck, no invasion threatened. No ambitious Fan Zhen tried to take over the center of the Tang Empire. The kingdoms of Balhae and Unified Silla and Yamato Japan were preoccupied with their own affairs. During the rule of Tang Wenzong's successor, the Uyghur Empire to the north was divided by civil war and disintegrated. Nomads from the north took advantage of its weakness to invade and sack the Uyghur capital, Ordu Balik, and its people fled to the south and west. And the Tibetan Empire, which had for so long troubled the southwestern border of the Tang, was ripped apart by a religious war. The tentative stability of the Tang meant that the emperors and their eunuchs could concentrate on trade, on that useful salt monopoly, on careful tax collection, and on literary pursuits. In 869, during the reign of the Emperor Tang Yizong, the King of Unified Silla even sent his son, the Sillan Crown Prince, to study in the Chinese capital. All continued well, until the dreaded military crisis erupted. It came not from outside, but from inside. And although it was not led by one of the Fan Zhen, it was precipitated by the same tension that many of them felt, that of an outsider who wished to become an insider. In 874, a young man named Huang Chao took the civil service examination and failed it. He was furious. Since childhood, Huang Chao had been known for his intelligence and his literary abilities, and he could not believe that the exam had judged him unworthy. The examination system had been criticized before. A few decades earlier, the public official and poet Han Yu had complained bitterly that the training that prepared students to do well on the exams merely taught literary tricks and pat answers, and had nothing to do with real learning. Now Huang Chao, smarting from his failure, proclaimed that the exam system was nothing more than a tool of exclusion, used by the government to block the unwanted from official positions. Huang Chao turned outlaw. Stationing himself in the northeast of China, near the coast and just south of the Yellow River, he began to sell salt illegally, breaking the government monopoly, which he believed to be unjust. He was soon joined by other malcontents. Several bad growing seasons in the north of China meant that too many farmers were hungry and desperate. The band of smugglers grew larger and began to indulge in Robin Hood escapades, robbing rich merchants on the nearby roads, raiding wealthy towns, and then attacking and killing foreign traders along the coast. Tang troops were finally dispatched from Chang'an to arrest the troublemakers, but Huang Chao and his confederates fought back. More and more farmers and peasants joined their cause. Before long, the robber band had swelled into a full-fledged rebellion with over 500,000 followers. 4 years of fighting followed. The rebels captured Luoyang and fought their way far south, crossing the Yangtze and capturing Tang land all the way down to the city of Guangzhou. From this base, Huang Chao turned back north and began to make his way towards Chang'an itself. In 880, he arrived at the walls of the capital city and captured it in what he later called a bloodbath. The Emperor Tang Xizong, Tang Yizong's successor, fled with his court from the city and fortified himself instead at the western city of Chengdu. In control of the capital city and the palace, Huang Chao ascended the throne and announced himself king of a new dynasty. Tang Xizong, determined to fight back, hired Turkish mercenaries from the northern border tribes of the Chateau to reinforce his damaged army. Like the Fanzhen, they were a more or less independent military power on the outer edge of Tang power. Unlike the Fanzhen, who hoped to escape Tang control altogether, the Chateau were outsiders who desperately wished to be insiders. The Chateau commander, Li Keong, a Turk who had already adopted a Chinese name and Chinese customs, led 40,000 horsemen south and helped Tang Xizong lay siege to Chang'an. In 882, outside Chang'an's walls, the Tang army and the Turkish mercenaries together met an enormous rebel army commanded by Huang Chao. The Battle of Liang Tianpo was a defeat for Huang Chao. He was driven northwards, away from Chang'an and the land he had already conquered, back towards the home territory of the Chateau. Li Qiong followed him, harassing him all the way. In this he was aided by one of Huang Chao's former allies, Zhu Wen, who had deserted Huang Chao and gone over to the side of the Tang. He was given charge of part of the royal army, and together the two men worked to put the rebellion down. The rebels met the government forces again in 884 on the banks of the Yellow River. This time, Huang Chao and his men were decisively defeated. Huang Chao, fleeing from the carnage, was cornered and committed suicide, so that Li Qiong would not get the credit for his capture. The Emperor Tang Xizong rewarded Li Qiong by making him the military governor of most of the north. He then returned to Chang'an, but his re-entry was far from triumphant. The empire was in tatters. The cities of Luoyang and Yangzhou had been put to the torch. The city of Chang'an was destroyed and demoralized. Chang'an lies in mournful stillness. What does it now contain? Mourned the poet Wei Zhuang. Ruined markets and desolate streets in which ears of wheat are sprouting. Fuel gatherers have hacked down every flowering plant in the apricot gardens. Builders of barricades have destroyed the willows along the imperial canal. All the pomp and magnificence of the olden days are buried and passed away. Only a dreary waste meets the eye. All along the street of heaven one treads on the bones of state officials. Tang Xizong had kept his title, but his power was gone and the days of his dynasty were drawing to an end. He was succeeded in 888 by his son Tang Xiaozong, who presided over a dying world. For two more decades the empire lingered on, while the turncoat Zhu Wen and the Turkish general Li Qiong continued to grow in power. Li Qiong had extended his military governorship of the north into a minor kingship, just as Fan Zhen, given the chance, had always done. He had installed his own Chateau allies in official positions throughout his realm, and no longer acknowledged the rule of the Tang Emperor. He had also fallen out with his co-commander Zhu Wen. After the end of the rebellion, Zhu Wen had begun to resent the greater rewards given to Li Qiong. He had been slowly taking for himself more and more land between Chang'an and the borders of Li Qiong's province. In 901 and 902, he tried to invade Li Qiong's land, and both times was driven back. But Zhu Wen had more luck in Chang'an itself. Fearing the power of the general Li Qiong and hoping to keep Zhu Wen loyal, the emperor gave him a royal title. Zhu Wen accepted the title and then began a slow, careful campaign to isolate the emperor from his supporters, killing or exiling them as traitors, surrounding the unfortunate emperor with his own men, and finally ordering, in the emperor's name, that the whole royal court be moved to the city of Luoyang. This raised alarm all over the remnants of the empire, and from various cities, loyal officials and soldiers set out for Luoyang, determined to rescue the emperor. When Zhu Wen heard of their approach, he sent his own men to murder the emperor, and then, loudly proclaiming his own loyalty to the crown, executed the assassins. The would-be rescuers, either deceived or giving up hope, withdrew. Zhu Wen then authorized the coronation of the emperor's 13-year-old son as Tang Aidi, a true puppet king, thoroughly under the general's control. The outsider had arrived almost at the center of the Tang Empire. He was king in all but name. The name came next. The following year, Zhu Wen forced Tang Aidi to decree the murder of his 9 remaining brothers and all the ministers who were still loyal to the royal family. They were strangled, and their bodies were thrown into a nearby river. Now Zhu Wen was ready to claim the title for himself. He forced the 16-year-old emperor to abdicate and founded his own dynasty, the Later Liang. It was a short-lived dynasty. The Later Liang would only survive from 907 until 923, but the abdication of the last Tang emperor and his murder the following year plunged China into a roiling mass of struggle between minor kingdoms. This period, known as the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms, would last until 960. In a span of just over 50 years, the Fan Zhen would create and then lose a slew of minor realms. Five ruling dynasties would rise and fall in the north. More than 10 separate kingdoms would appear and disappear in the south. Author's note, the five dynasties were the later Liang, 907 to 923, later Tang, 923 to 936, later Jin, 936 to 947, later Han, 947 to 950, and later Zhao, 955 to 960. The Ten Kingdoms were the Wu, 907 to 937, Wu Yue, 907 to 978, Min, 909 to 945, Chu, 907 to 950, Southern Han, 917 to 971, former Shu, 907 to 925, later Shu, 934 to 965, Jing Nan, 924 to 963, Southern Tang, 937 to 970, and Northern Han, 951 to 979. In the far northern lands, a new empire arose. The northern Khitan war chief, Abaoji, made an alliance with the Shatuo and began a series of conquests that would eventually create an enormous Khitan realm. With the death of the last Tang emperor, the inside of China had disappeared, and only the outside remained. As the Fan Zhen divided China among themselves, the castle lords of unified Silla were carving lines into their own homeland, and the cracks were deepening to the point of fracture. The king Gyeongmun, who had sent his son to study in Tang China before its fall, had unwittingly driven a wedge into the fissures. He had married a well-born noblewoman, but she had not borne him an heir, so he had married her sister as well. The second bride was equally barren. While the two royal sisters existed in unhappy tension at the palace, one of King Gyeongmun's concubines bore him a son and heir. The two queens, resentful and afraid, arranged for the concubine and her baby to be murdered. But as her mistress was dying, the child's wet nurse snatched her charge away from the assassins and fled with him, finally taking refuge at a monastery. The little boy, Gong Ge, grew up there, nurtured by the monks and aware of his royal heritage. He could never forget the murder of his mother and his own displacement. He had lost an eye in the assassination attempt. Some years later, another of the king's concubines gave birth to a second son. Gyeongmun protected this child, named him Crown Prince, and dispatched him to China to learn the principles of Confucian government. Returning to his homeland, the boy became King Heonggang after his father's death. He must have discovered the truth about the older half-brother exiled in a monastery. We know nothing about his reaction. During the 11 years of his reign, Heonggang did his best to pretend that all was well, in part by spending money like water and burnishing the capital city to a high gloss. Every house had a tile roof. Every fireplace burned charcoal rather than cheaper firewood, so that the skies remained clear of wood smoke. Meanwhile, 100 miles out from Gyeongju, the countryside seethed with thieves and bandits, private armies and ambitious warlords. Most of Yonggang's courtiers seem to have encouraged his delusion that all was well with his country, but the poet and scholar, Choe Chi-won, was an exception. The son of a Silan aristocrat, Choe Chi-won had also spent his school years in Tang China. Unlike Yonggang, he had actually absorbed the principles of Confucian government. The Samguk Sagi tells us that he passed the civil service exam in China on his first try, and was appointed chief of personnel for a Tang province. But as his adopted country began to spin into chaos, Choe Chi-won returned home. In 885, Choe Chi-won applied for a post in Heonggang's government. He wanted to reform Silla before it too collapsed, but Heonggang and his hangers-on weren't enthusiastic. Upon returning to Korea, the Samguk Sagi says, Choe Chi-won wished to realize his ideas, but these were decadent times, and, an object of suspicion and envy, he was not accepted. The following year, King Heonggang died without an heir. First his brother and then his sister, Jin Seong, inherited the throne and its problems. Jin Seong ruled for 10 years, from 887 to 897, while Silla crumpled around her. Queen Jin Seong comes off badly in the contemporary accounts. She was of manly build, one chronicle tells us, and then reverses itself and accuses her of bringing pretty young men to court and installing them in paper positions. To be female and on the throne during the collapse of a medieval kingdom generally elicited accusations of lust, corruption, and general viciousness. The queen's sex life becomes a convenient explanation for the end of an era. But the real culprits in Scylla's ongoing crisis were the castle lords, who continued to shake down the peasants and farmers who lived under their power, building luxurious lives on the backs of Scylla's labourers. Queen Jinseong tried to keep her government funded by cracking down on taxpayers. Taxes from rural areas hadn't reached the capital for years, so she ordered armed men to perform a forced tax collection. This was a desperate and short-sighted solution. The farmers and craftsmen had been paying tax all along. The payments had just gone into the coffers of their local castle lords. Now they were paying double taxes. Poverty and desperation drove more men into careers as bandits. Grass brigands, the contemporary chronicles call them, and before long the bandits were organizing themselves into small and powerful anti-government armies under capable rebel leaders. The lands just below Gyeongju were dominated by the red-trousered bandits. A farmer-turned-soldier named Kyeonhwon led a rebel army in the southwest, and a robber leader named Yang Gil organized the resistance to the northeast. His second-in-command was none other than Kong Ye, the one-eyed prince, now grown and hoping to reclaim some of the power that could have been his. For the moment, though, the farmer Kyeonhwon had emerged as the strongest of the rebel leaders. In 892, Queen Jinseong tried to stave him off by giving him a title. She awarded him the rule of the lands south of the capital, along with the honorary appellation Duke of the Southwest. With this semi-official authority behind him, Kyeonhwon negotiated an agreement with Yang Gil and his right-hand man, Kong Ye. He would rule in the southwest, and they would govern an area farther to the north. Over the next few years, Kyeonhwon firmed up his hold on the southwest lands, while the one-eyed prince Kong Ye built his power to the north. In name, Kong Ye remained second in command to the bandit leader Yang Gil. In reality, he was collecting personal support for himself, sleeping on the ground with his men, dividing his spoils evenly with them and suffering their hardships. Meanwhile, Queen Jinseong remained on her throne, but she was rapidly becoming a monarch in name only. Once again, the Confucian scholar-poet Choe Chi-won tried to help out, this time by submitting a 10-point proposal for reform that would, in his estimation, have begun to lift the remains of the Sillan kingdom out of its current mudhole. Once again, his reforms were rejected by the Sillan court. Choe Chi-won left the doomed palace and retreated to a distant mountain monastery, where he devoted himself instead to the pursuits of the spirit and the composition of mournful lyrics in Chinese. The frenzied rush through the rocks roars at the peaks and drowns out the human voices close by. Because I always fear disputes between right and wrong, I have arranged the waters to cage in these mountains. Back at court, Queen Jinseong was forced to give up her throne. The courtiers brought forward a boy whom they claimed to be yet another son of Yonggang, this one the child of a girl from an outlying village where the king had spent the night during a hunting trip. In 897, Queen Jinseong abdicated in his favour, and the 14-year-old boy became King Hyogong. Kong Ye, the one-eyed prince, is said to have responded to the exaltation of his supposed half-brother by finding his portrait and slashing it to bits with his sword. His own ambitions were becoming clearer. Later that same year, Kong Ye murdered his chief, Yang Gil, and made himself leader of the rebels in the north. By 900, the Duke of the Southwest, the ex-farmer Kyeonhwon, felt secure enough to proclaim himself king. Kyeonhwon had actually been born in the old territory of ancient Silla, but the land where he was most powerful had once belonged to the old Baekje, so he named his new state later Baekje. The following year, Kong Ye followed suit. He too was a native Sillan, but he centered his new state at Kaesong in the old lands of Goguryeo and named his kingdom later Goguryeo. The days of unified Silla had ended. Once again, three nations occupied the peninsula. All peace had ended. Choe Chi-won lamented that the bodies of those who had starved to death or fallen in action were scattered about the plain like stars. The observation is repeated by Wang Kon, a competent naval officer who fought in the forces of Kong Ye. "People scattered in all directions," he wrote, "leaving skeletons exposed on the ground." The period of the later three kingdoms had begun with war and famine. The one-eyed Kong Ye, driven by anger as well as ambition, intended to completely destroy the remnants of Scylla. He spent the first years as king of Leta Gorgurio pushing deeper and deeper into Scyllan territory, while the young Scyllan king, Hyogong, took refuge from a hopeless future in alcohol. Slowly, Kung Ye's resentment and fury unbalanced his mind. When he was not fighting, he was parading through his new kingdom on a white horse, clad in a purple robe and a gold crown, with a choir of 200 monks following behind to sing his praises. He grew paranoid, ordering first his wife and then both of his sons put to death for treachery. Kung Ye, wrote his general, Wang Kon, became tyrannical and cruel. He considered treacherous means to be the best, and intimidation and insults to be necessary devices. Frequent corvée labor and heavy taxes exhausted the people, forcing them to abandon the land. Yet the palace was grand and imposing, and he ignored the established conventions. Wang Kon is hardly an objective observer. By 918, Kung Ye had become so unbearably tyrannical that his own officers murdered him and elevated Wang Kon to the kingship instead. Kung Ye had claimed ties both to the royal house of the present and to the old Gorgurian kingdom of the past, but his rule was supported by military might, not by aristocratic lineage. He had claimed his crown by conquest, not by right of blood, and in doing so set himself up to die by the same sword with which he had lived. Chapter 55. The Third Dynasty. Between 809 and 833, the Abbasid Caliphate is challenged by the independent Tahirids to the east. In 809, the righteous Caliph Harun al-Rashid was on his way to Khorasan with an army. The people of the province were making rebellious noises of revolt, and al-Rashid had decided to tend to the matter in person. But he grew ill on the journey and was forced to halt at the little town of Tus, where he died. He left a fortune behind. It has been said, al-Tabari writes, that there were 900 million odd dirhams in the state treasury, which, if true, means that al-Rashid died with 3,000 tons of silver in his possession. Al-Rashid had wavered over the choice of an heir. His oldest son, Al-Amin, was the obvious choice, but he was